welcome to this week's episode of the Green for Health podcast with Angela Hayes.
Hello and welcome to Green for Health, where today I'm joined by Dr. Cliff Shelton. Cliff is a consultant anaesthetist at Manchester Foundation Trust, where he's a departmental lead for sustainability. He's a clinical lecturer in anaesthetics at Lancaster Medical School and a teacher, researcher in sustainable healthcare with a focus on anaesthesia and perioperative medicine. A leading light in healthcare sustainability, Cliff was shortlisted this year for his Net Zero project at the Health Service Journal Awards. Really lovely for you to join us today, Cliff. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
So, we had a chat before we spoke, before we've got going, and I was just a bit overwhelmed with all the stuff that you've done, really. Can I ask how you first got involved in the sustainability? What kicked you off?
Well, I guess, I suppose what kicked me off was having a personal interest in it. So I think I've probably got my mum to thank for that. You know, when we were kids, I think things like the hole in the ozone layer was a very topical thing when we were growing up. And I think that really captured my mum's imagination and filtered down to me and my brother. And so we've always been, a family that tries to do things like, you know, recycle and, you know, drive an economical car and keep a check on the amount of, air travel we do and think about what we eat, you know, those sorts of things. And then I went to medical school and didn't really think a great deal about that professionally until I went to Macclesfield Hospital as a fairly junior trainee anaesthetist. And one of my mentors there kind of pointed out that some of the things we use in anaesthesia to keep patients asleep are greenhouse gases, and that some of the choices that we make as anaesthetists can influence, you know, our carbon footprint professionally as well as personally. So I suppose that kind of piqued my interest in it. And a few years after that, I got myself a teaching job at Keele Medical School. And one of the things that Keele as a university is very keen on is that their students, whatever it is that they're studying, understand the environmental implications of their course. So I guess if you're, you know, for example, studying building surveying, I don't even know if they run that course, but if that's what you're studying, I guess you need to know something about the environmental impact of buildings. And I was working on the undergraduate medicine course, and I had a conversation with the course director and asked, well, what are we doing about that for our undergraduate medics? And it was just good timing, really. He said, well, do you know, that's something we've been thinking about. And if you'd like to develop something, then, you know, be our guest. So I got into working with some colleagues there at Keele on that. And I've really kind of taken it forwards from there.
Very often when you ask the question about anything like this, you ask the question, is there anybody doing anything on this? That they go, no, there isn't. Do you want to? And then you find yourself, you've been given a job before you know it. And then...
Yeah, that is true. And it's nice to meet somebody else who suffered the same. But I suppose to flip that on its head, there's lots of opportunity here, isn't there? And I mean, I do some research in a number of different fields, and some of them feel very crowded. You know, looking for something that's novel to do can be quite difficult. But I think sustainable healthcare has got lots of opportunities because it's got lots of uncertainties, basically.
I think it's going to be absolutely massive, this. I think it's just got going, really. From, you know, when I talk about it, I kind of describe myself as being late to the party, really. I think, I mean, how long ago was all of this that when ago was that, Cliff? Is it?
Well, I think I was at Keele about 10 years ago now. Right. So I guess probably my HO job must have been a bit before that, maybe 2010 or something like that. I think they were ahead of their field, actually, at Macclesfield back then. And I, looking back, you know, now at some of the literature that has kind of defined our thinking around inhalational anaesthetics and greenhouse gases, 2010 is about when they were coming out. So yeah, I would guess that was probably when it was, and it was probably that those papers captured the attention of the people who I was working for. So yeah, I guess that's when it was for us about 10 or 12 years ago just now.
So that's when you first got going on it. So at that time, I was kind of blissfully unaware of all of this and living in a nice little happy world of where I didn't always have to see things through my sustainability goggles, which they're never removed now. So, I feel very late to the party. So you're a good few years ahead of me on all of this. So in that time then, Cliff, can you tell us a little bit about what you've been up to? Are you able to summarise it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose most of my work has been educational. So building on that, that year I spent at Keele, I've gone back and I've done some more teaching with them. In the meantime, I've got myself a new job at Lancaster, which I've been doing for 3 years. It's actually my colleague, Fliss Connolly, who's a GP, who leads the sustainability part of our curriculum there. But one of the things that she's keen to do, which I think I, you know, completely support, is to build little bits of sustainability into kind of everywhere where there's an opportunity to do it. So, you know, I do a talk on, for example, pain relief in labour to our medical students, and we'll just have a discussion, for example, about nitrous oxide as part of that, but set in context with everything else, because it'd be very easy to say to them that nitrous oxide is a horrible greenhouse gas that destroys the ozone layer and leave them with the impression that it should just be kind of run out of town in every context. But of course, for some patients, it's what they want. And it's the best tool for some specific jobs. But I think those jobs are quite specific. But unless they understand both bits of that, you know, not only what its harms are, but what its benefits are, they can't really reach a kind of value proposition about it. So I think, you know, that's been a big part of it. We've also been running in the northwest of England some sustainable anaesthesia fellowships. So those are in their third year now. And I mean, those doctors who've been doing those with us have been amazingly successful. We've had five of them now. And although number five is sort of early days, you know, the first four who've done that piece of work have all achieved outcomes which have been recognised nationally, which is amazing, really, and kind of underlines, you know, as I said before, just how many unknowns there are here and what a significant contribution people can make if they're prepared to give it a bit of a whirl.
I bet you feel so proud of that, do you, then, if you've kind of planted this sustainability seed, if you know, again, and pardon the pun, but I bet you feel very proud that then you see these people go on to...
Yeah, well, I feel proud of them. You know, I have to say, I supervise a fair few, you know, students and trainee doctors here and there, and they're some of the nicest supervisees you could ever wish for, right, because they tend to be recruited into the role because they're enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, and you don't need to galvanise them. Yeah.
No, exactly. So there's no selling anything to them. It tends to be helping them to develop an idea. And then off they go, you know, and they've been amazingly helpful and amazingly productive and, you know, have gone on to, you know, to really good things and have kept that kind of sustainability theme going. So, yeah, I'm really proud of them. I think they've done fantastic. And it's great to have the opportunity to work like that, you know, and have a bit of flexibility in anaesthetics training. I think that's something that, you know, the anaesthetics colleges, the Royal College of Anaesthetists, has done very well, is to leave a little bit of flexibility in anaesthetic training so you can do something that interests you. Mm-hmm. And we've done these sustainability fellowships under the sort of banner of them being you know, modules in research and quality improvement, which is what they are, but with a sustainability slant to them.
Safety as well. And
yeah, absolutely. There's a few different ways that you could take it. But I don't think every postgraduate training curriculum has got that sort of ability to sub-specialise in something flexible like that. So that's been really, really good. And so I suppose that's been my kind of my teaching bit. I've got a research interest, although I think of myself more as an educator than a researcher in this respect. But one of the things that's been really exciting that we've done over the last couple of years is something called Greener Operations. And that's what's called a James Lind Alliance Priority Setting Partnership. And there's over 100 of these have been done for various things. And the idea is that most of the time, the agenda for research gets set by people with research monies or, you know, prominent researchers in fields or sometimes industry. But it's very seldom set by patients and carers and members of the public, who at the end of the day are the people who, you know, have their lives changed by medical research. So the James Lind Alliance is something that exists to give those people a voice, together with jobbing clinicians. Of course, you know, people who are, for example, just doing anaesthetics don't necessarily get to be represented when it comes to the decisions about, you know, what might affect their practice. So for the last couple of years, we've been running what I think is the first priority setting partnership on a sustainable healthcare topic. And it's about environmentally sustainable perioperative practice. So it's not just anaesthesia, it's surgery, it's maybe physiotherapy, it's the getting the patient ready for an operation and helping them to recover afterwards. The whole lot, exactly. And it's been a really interesting process. We got together a group of, I think, about 15 people, various professions, patient representatives and so on, to run this with us. And basically, we started off by asking members, well, it could be anybody, but it was a public survey, to nominate what questions they think or thought needed answering around the topic of sustainable healthcare. And we got something like 1,600 responses to that, 1,600 questions, which just goes to show how engaged people are.
I was just going to say that wasn't what sustainable healthcare. They weren't asking that. They knew exactly what that involved and what you were asking.
Well, I guess the way we asked the question had a bit of an explainer at the start of it to explain what it was. And then this was actually our first two fellows, Max and Rishi. Their job was to take those 1,600 things, sort through them and kind of organise them into themes and develop those themes into summary questions and then check that they've not been answered. And then we sent those summary questions out for a second survey where people got to pick the most important ones to them. And then we took the ones where, most people thought they were important to a sort of final workshop, again, with health professionals and patients and carers and so on, and work with some very skilled facilitators from the James Lind Alliance organisation to sort of define what these top 10 research priorities were. And so that's something that you can find on the website. You know, if you pop in James Lind Alliance Greener Operations to Google, you'll find it, and they're there to be found. And hopefully there's a paper coming soon to go with them. But that's been really, really exciting, because it kind of gives, I think it's very important that this isn't just something that, a small group of individuals get to decide about. And the things that I thought were really important were some of the questions about how you balance different types of value. So, for example, how do you square away environmental impacts with clinical benefits, with how much something costs financially? And it was really interesting watching the discussions around questions that related to that in the workshop, because the patients weren't shy about that. I was a bit worried, maybe with my, the baggage I carry as a health professional, that patients might find it, offensive, that decisions might be made about anything other than their clinical benefits. But, I suppose we're used to balancing clinical benefit and money. That's a well-known concept within
healthcare. Yes, there isn't just kind of an infinite amount of funding that is available for everybody. People are realistic, I think, these days, aren't they?
And so, although, of course, we didn't get, these are questions that we're defining, not answers. It was important to me to learn that the members of the public who contributed to this were open to the idea that there should be a debate around that. So I thought that was a really constructive process. Mm. And I'm hoping, I think we've just got the reviews back on the paper, that'll be out in print before too long. But it's there on the website, and it's there to help researchers to decide what to look at. So that's been a big part of our our lives for the last couple of years, and you know, tremendous amount of energy has gone into that from my colleagues on the steering group, and in particular David Jones, who's a surgeon who I work with, who was my sort of co-lead on that. And and it was funded out of the trust charity, so the MFT trust charity, which again is great, isn't it?
Fantastic.
The trust is happy to invest. It wasn't loads of money, but it's a, you know, a substantial thing to run a national project for 2 years. You know, the trust is happy to invest in something like this, which just underlines how important it is.
Did that take a bit of convincing then, a bit of selling to the trust, or?
No, it was like pushing on an open door, really. You know, I think the trust is well aware. I mean, I suppose it's the trust charity, but the trust charity needs, you know, to work with the aims of the trust itself. But the trust is well aware that, you know, public health stuff is really important to the workload of the trust. And that's essentially, you know, one way of looking at sustainable healthcare is that if healthcare, you know, doesn't check its own contribution to, you know, environmental harms, then healthcare is going to pick up some of the fallout of this and effectively create work for itself. So, no, I don't think there was, you know, there was obviously the usual due diligence that comes with funding a project. You know, is it achievable and have we got the right resources in place and so on? But, you know, I'm happy to say there was it was not very much pushback at all. I can't remember any, in fact, against the concept that we should be looking into this as a topic and, you know, helping to lead this, you know, the development of a research agenda around sustainable perioperative care.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Almost like a spend to save thing then.
Well, who knows? It could be, couldn't it? I mean, you know, the economics of this are very difficult in general, you know, so, I mean, actually, I'll move on to something else we've been doing for the last few years to illustrate this point. So we've done, you know, I mentioned before, research, you know, as kind of getting primary data isn't my, you know, it is, I do a bit of it, but I don't do loads of it for sustainable healthcare. But one thing we did do was to look at something called cracking, catalytic cracking for nitrous oxide. And this is like it's a thing that's about the size of a refrigerator, and you wheel it into a room where somebody's using gas and air, and they breathe out into this device, and it turns the nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas, back into nitrogen and oxygen using a catalyst, or at least it does in theory. But we wanted to see whether it did so in practice, because the most obvious place to use a device like that is in the delivery ward, when, you know, with women in labour, there are kind of major users of nitrous oxide. You know, there's lots of reasons that I'm sure I don't need to go into in detail why it might not be straightforward for a woman in labour to, you know, breathe out into a mouthpiece or into a face mask and make sure that all that exhaled breath goes down this tube and into this this machine. I think, you know, most women in labour have got enough to worry about without you know, being given
other things on their mind. Yeah.
So there was kind of, you know, even though, you know, the device is you know, is very sound in terms of its workings, you know, and we sort of checked that with a bench experiment, we were intrigued to know whether it would perform well in the real world. And, you know, in summary, we found that it performed pretty well, although with some kind of caveat. So you just needed to be careful about making sure that you used it in a way that the patients found to be straightforward and easy and patient-centered. And we also found that the midwives who work obviously at the patient's side, you know, are absolutely critical in making sure that it worked. But that's put us in an interesting position, which is that we could, in fact, we hope to look into procuring some of these devices. But finding the money for that has got its own set of challenges, because there isn't a big pile of money that NHS trusts have set aside for technological investment in sustainability. And like you say, you know, you can justify this on a kind of spend to save kind of a way, but there isn't a clear model for how in particular public sector organisations, to justify capital bids for things that reduce their carbon footprint. So that's a challenge that we're dealing with, and I don't have the answers yet, but it's a really interesting concept. And I think, you know, there's general broad agreement that, you know, this is a social good and that, you know, it needs to happen. But working through the details of, you know, whose budget, for example, in an organisation that might come out of is a very interesting problem that we're kind of in the thick of at the moment.
Because can I just check with so in that kind of situation in the labour ward and the midwives are using the nitrous frequently, is there concerns about their long-term exposure to this
gas? There is, and I suppose that makes a good point about what we mean when we talk about environmental pollution. That I think if I was looking at the greener NHS dashboard, I might think about nitrous oxide in terms of, you know, tons of CO2 equivalents and what could be done about that. But if I was the ward manager of a labour ward, I might be more concerned about the very local environmental pollution, you know, within the room that my staff are breathing in. And so nitrous oxide is known to be safe if you use it for a short period of time in labour, but it's also known to be potentially harmful if you're exposed to it over a long period of time, for example, occupationally. And there's a set of regulations that specify what the maximum exposure should be over a certain period of time. And in this country, it's 100 parts per million on average over 8 hours. But in other countries, it's as low as, I think, 20 parts per million. And there's evidence to suggest that even that is probably a bit permissive. Didn't find any real evidence that we were going above the 100, you know, apart from in some isolated cases. But there has been evidence published where they've looked at levels in maternity wards and found that they are unacceptably high. And it probably depends on things like, you know, the size of your room and, you know, the ventilation and so on. But yeah, that's a potential, you know, really interesting potential reason why this kind of technology might be a bit of a win-win. You know, it might be good for the environment, but it might be good for those individuals as well.
Because it just makes me think, would, you know, staff health and midwife health be something that would be on risk registers in department, you know, in maternity departments, not having worked in them since I've been a student nurse, I wouldn't know, but.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly could be, but I think the way that we'd look at risk in this country is to go with those COSH guidelines, you know, control of substances hazardous to health. And as I mentioned, you know, in our particular case, our hospital is doing a good job by those COSH guidelines, you know, and so we're not breaching any kind of you know, any kind of regulation as far as we can see. But I do know that you know, if you dig through the papers, you'll find hospitals where those regulations have been breached, and that might provide an additional lever. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? You know, where do you set the threshold of you know, this is good enough, or this is adequate? Do we want to drive everything down to zero, or do we have a kind of a point where we can say, actually, this is fine, and we'll stop? And again, it's not a question I can answer, but it's an interesting concept.
Oh, very good. So that's the project that you've just you're just finishing, or you're I was going to ask kind of what was next on the horizon, really. So this is something that's underway, and have you got plans for other things?
Yeah, well, so I think that's, you know, that's kind of shifted now from an evaluation project into a implementation project. And, you know, so that's I'm expecting that to use a good deal of energy. I don't know, you know, maybe we'll have another podcast in a year where I can tell you if it went okay or not.
That'd be great.
That's quite exciting. You know, and there's a few other kind of practical things we're doing at the moment. Another one to do with nitrous oxide is around removing the piped nitrous oxide supply from our operating theatres. I think a lot of people are doing that. A lot of trusts are doing that.
But yeah, that's been in the process of doing that.
Yeah, it's been quite a quite an adventure getting there. And again, another insight into the inner workings of the National Health Service. And again, we've not had any, you know, amazing lack of objections to that. I've, you know, don't think I've ever had to, you know, have an argument or a debate with anybody about, you know, the approach that we've taken. But there's just an awful lot of stuff to get through to get a decision made. And on the one hand, that's... On the one hand, it's reasonable because, you know, if you get a decision about a medicine wrong, it could impact on patient care. But on the other hand, it's kind of got its frustrations as well.
And I think, I don't know about at your place, Cliff, but my understanding at different hospitals, my own included, is that from a clinical perspective, you get that right, it's fine, we don't need the pipe nitrous, because it's about the leaky pipes, isn't it? Old leaky pipes, and that's the main concern, isn't it? That huge proportions of this gas leaks out from these leaky pipes, but you can have replacements in canisters. That's normally, is that your experience as well?
Well, do you know, we actually didn't bother to find out what the reason for our degree of waste was. So we looked at the amount of nitrous oxide that we order, and we looked at the amount that we use, and we found that we essentially 98.5% of the nitrous oxide that we order goes to waste. And we order a lot of nitrous oxide at our place. And when we spoke to our anaesthetic department, we said to them, well, we've got a choice here. We can either go after this problem and we can invest the time and the effort to try and work out, for example, do we have a leak somewhere in the system, or, you know, is this just about poor stock rotation, or is it, you know, somebody leaving their anaesthetic machine on when they shouldn't? And we had a talk about it, and actually nobody seems to use this drug as a routine part of their practice at all. And, you know, whilst there are some people who use it as part of their technique in certain circumstances, we agreed that actually it would be a waste of effort to go and track the problem down. We'd probably end up doing anyway was then deciding that we didn't need the service. So we skipped that stage. But yeah, a lot of people have found that there's leaks. And if you look at our, you know, Withenshire Hospital where I work, it's got some very modern bits, it's got some very old bits, and the nitrous oxide supply system spans the whole hospital campus. And I remember being sent a map of all the nitrous oxide pipelines when I was kind of early on in this project. And you've never seen anything so complicated. You know, it's
not the underground map, was it? Right.
Well, the underground map is simple in comparison.
Oh, right. And, yeah, right.
You know, and it's as well, it's striking. You know, some of these pipes are absolutely huge. You know, the manifold, which is kind of like down beside pharmacy, supplies something as far away as kind of being over near our anaesthetic department. And I reckon that would take me 5 minutes to walk, so maybe it's a quarter of a mile, you know, that some of these pipes are going. And you can understand just by looking at the map why there might be leaks in this system, because it's so complex. And yet, you know, it's a drug that is rarely used. So, you know, that's been a real education to me to go through that process. And what is good, actually, even though it's taken us, I was looking back, actually, we just this week, last week, now I think about it, we actually started to blank off the nitrous oxide outlets in our operating theatres. I was scrolling back to the top of our nitrous oxide WhatsApp group to see when it was that we started thinking about it. And it's taken us 14 months to go from starting to think about it to, you know, sort of implementation. But our trust, Manchester University Foundation Trust, is a big sort of citywide organisation, of which Withenshire Hospital is just one part. And I think, even though it's taken us a while to go through and sort of figure out, you know, how to get the permissions sorted out, and there's bits of kind of, you know, there's technological solutions. They're not high tech, but it's like, you know, we've got, we're calling them mobile manifolds. They're just cylinders on trolleys with a valve on the top that you can plug your anaesthetic machine into. But each of those components, you know, the valve and the trolley and so on, needs to be procured, and you need to figure out where to buy them from and make sure they're on your books as a supplier and all that kind of thing. But that bit of work has now been done for our trust. And if another hospital wants to do the same thing, which they do, it should be a lot more streamlined for them. So,
I'm, you know, scribbling like away, I said, now, thinking we're in the process of doing this at our place. Yeah. I'm scribbling away.
Well, we're not keeping it a secret. You know, if you want to use any of our governance materials or whatever, that'd be great. And anybody listening, you know, just send me a message if you want to talk about how it's done. But yeah, so I think to an extent, we've kind of, we know we've used a bit more time than we, than it might otherwise take. But being fairly early on, at least in our city, in doing this project has meant that we've got to do some learning as we go, and hopefully others will find it a bit easier.
Right. And do you know, like, the savings that you've made in the form of finance and CO2 equivalent and all of that? Have you got those figures, or is it too early?
No. So, well, we can predict them. So the pipeline hasn't been turned off yet. We've got to be very kind of, we're being careful, I suppose, in terms of wanting to have a 2-week pause after every phase of the project. So, you know, just over 2 weeks ago, we unplugged the anaesthetic machines and introduced the mobile manifolds. And then we waited for 2 weeks to make sure that nothing went wrong. And now we've plugged up the wall valves, and we're going to wait another 2 weeks to make sure that doesn't provoke any disasters. And then we're going to formally decommission the manifold. So it'll be mid-December when, the big switch off happens.
And you can do the equivalent of crashing your champagne against a ship. You'll have to have some kind of, how are you going to do it? You'll have to have some kind of ceremony.
My colleague, who's the sort of medical lead for the medical gas committee, has to sign a piece of paper to authorize it. We thought we'd get him a sparkly pen, like when you sign your wedding register, and take a photograph of him. That's the process. But we've predicted how much it's going to save. And one of the interesting things is it's not going to save a great deal of money from drugs. It's going to save quite a lot of money from a maintenance and life cycling point of view. But if I remember rightly, our hospital spends it's something like £40,000 or £50,000 a year on pipe nitrous oxide. And although that's, you know, I would notice that hole in my bank account, you know, as I'm sure would you and everybody else. And I'd be delighted to receive it as a bonus, you know. That's not a great deal of money. That's not a great deal of money on the scale of a drugs budget of a 1,000-bedded hospital. And I think maybe the reason that we got ourselves into a situation where the majority of that drug was wasted is that it's not expensive enough for it to have caused any alarm bells. And I think, you know, maybe a message for anybody listening who hasn't looked at this is, you know, just not to make assumptions that just because you're using less of something, say nitrous oxide, that all the parts of a system are joined up and that the amount of it being ordered will go down accordingly. You know, it's not impossible at our hospital that, you know, we've been ordering a fixed amount of that, you know, since 1992, you know, and our use has just gone down a lot. I don't think it is that, actually, because we have a system whereby when a reduction in the gas pressure is detected, that's what triggers a changeover of cylinders and so on. So I suspect there probably is some leaks, but you know, I guess the point is that even though our use and our ordering were very, very different to each other, nobody thought to really look into this until I was made aware of this problem via colleagues, you know. And it's NHS Lothian, somebody called Alethea Shakira, who's a pharmacist and would probably be a really good podcast guest for the future. This is her thing that she thought up, and You know, she found this was the case in her hospital where she worked, and it's been duplicated over and over again. I think she mentioned to me that virtually every hospital that's done this has found, you know, 90% plus waste of nitrous oxide. So even though it sounds horrendous that we're wasting nearly 99% of it, we're not that unusual.
Yeah. I saw a lecture one time, probably about a year ago, where a doctor was saying about that these are average figures in the 90s, 90% of the gas is wasted. And it said, and it's not, this won't be just in my trust, this will be replicated. And it's staggering. That's fantastic. So, but as far as CO2 costs then, do you know about that?
Yeah, so our hospital seems to be the majority user of nitrous oxide amongst, or the majority orderer of nitrous oxide in MFT. And I think off the top of my head, it was something we would project to save about 2,300 tonnes of CO2 equivalent per year out of this, which is just a mind-boggling number. And to put that into context, that is something like, I think, 4% of the annual carbon footprint of our organisation overall. So, you know, our trust is the biggest acute NHS trust in the country. And to be able to chop 4% off its carbon footprint with a single project is quite amazing. You know, I don't think we'll do that again. We might have peaked with this piece of work if we can get it to work properly.
It's all downhill from now on.
it could be. This is a good time to resign potentially if I can get it to if I can get it to work.
Get your reward, get your MBE and then
yeah, maybe not.
So it's been really, really interesting talking to you. I could sit here all afternoon, but we kind of need to draw things to a close. Before we go, though, I just want to ask about how easy or difficult you found it to bring people along on your journey. Is that something that you've struggled with, or, you know, you needed lots of, you talked about how the nitrous, removing that was easy, and getting the funding was the open door. But generally speaking, have things been easy or have you struggled?
I mean, I think I'm very lucky to work in a hospital, which is very, you know, or a hospital and healthcare trust, which is very switched on to this. We've got a really, you know, incredible sustainability department who are very, very good at listening to people's ideas and to supporting them. So, you know, it's like, it's little things, isn't it? But if I needed to, well, so for example, we're trialing a little bit of kit in maternity at the moment, which might save us some carbon and save us some money. And in order to trial it, we needed to spend, I don't know, 200 quid on a few little bits and bobs. And the sustainability department were very happy to sort of step in and make it easy for us to do that.
Have they got their own budget then?
Well, they do, you know, and I think it's not unlimited, but for example, at the moment, they've got a little system of micro grants, they're calling them, where, you know, people, when they've got an idea, can apply for, you know, a few hundred quid, or I think it may be a little bit more than that actually, of funding to support something, you know, and that's available to all. And, you know, that kind of thing makes it easy for people to innovate and feel supported in doing so. So I think that's really important.
Fantastic, that, isn't it? Because it's about including the wider workforce then in this, and taking ownership, and then, you know, really love that idea. That's great.
Absolutely. So yeah, so that's really good. And then I think our department is very keen on sustainable healthcare in general. And I think anaesthesia as a specialty is quite a good place to be with this. Yeah. And there's a couple of reasons for it. One, as I mentioned before, you know, that we've got at least, you know, 10 or 15 years worth of people generating evidence and writing papers and speaking about this, you know, in the setting of anaesthesia, which means it's maybe a bit more mature than in some other clinical settings. Mm. And the other thing is that most of the stuff, I might say, this might be a bit controversial, but most of the stuff we do as anaesthetists, you can make an argument for doing an alternative and it being just as good for the patient. So, for example, You know, I work in broken hips. That's one of my, you know, areas of interest. And people have tried and tried and tried for years to decide whether a general anaesthetic or a spinal anaesthetic is better. And over again, there's basically been data to say, you know, it doesn't really matter from a, you know, an outcomes point of view.
Right. Okay.
And within general anaesthesia, you know, there's about, I don't know, 5 or 6 different drugs that you can use to keep someone asleep. And again, if you look in most circumstances, they're all as good as each other in terms of the kind of like the big deal things, whether you live or die, whether you get pneumonia, whether you, you know, get home on time, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's some smaller things, or there are things that might be important to the patient, you know, for example, nausea and vomiting, or, you know, whether you cough when you're asleep, you know, those kind of things that might be different between them, or whether you wake up, you know, 2 minutes earlier or 2 minutes later. But essentially, most of the things that we do, we don't have very strong evidence to push us down doing one or the other. So there's a lot of personal choice stuff you know, we can do in anaesthesia, safe in the knowledge that we're not making anything any worse for our patients. And, you know, if anything, the options that are a bit greener are often a little bit better for the patients and often a little bit nicer for the staff as well. And so I think that's one thing that makes making sustainable choices in anaesthesia is sometimes a bit easier, is that there's lots of things we can do that don't make anything any worse for anybody. And I don't know if that's the same in other specialties, but I can imagine it being a much tougher debate if you're having to decide to do this thing that could make your patient's life worse, or this thing that's really, really expensive rather than this other thing that's really cheap. So I think we're lucky in that respect. But no, I don't really find it difficult to bring people along. But I think for those reasons I've explained, my particular, you know, context is quite amenable to making sustainable choices.
Okay, brilliant. And if you had a magic wand, my final question, if you had a magic wand and you could wave it and do something, what would you do with regards kind of, you know, sustainable, the environment, that kind of stuff?
Well, I think with anaesthesia, nitrous oxide is our big deal at the moment. You know, the carbon footprint attributable to nitrous oxide is many times bigger than that attributable to inhaled anaesthetic agents.
Okay.
But it's the tricky one to remove. You know, we hadn't really talked about desflurane, but the way that you get rid of desflurane is just for your colleagues to say, I don't want to use it anymore. And then it, you know, kind of people stop buying it and it vanishes. Yeah. Nitrous oxide, as we've talked about, is a big structural thing to sort out. And yet, you know, over and over again, we find that 90% plus of it is wasted, and it's a bigger problem than anything else that we do in anaesthesia. So my magic wand would be to make it easy for colleagues to decommission their pipe nitrous oxide. That's the big win in anaesthesia, in my view.
And if we were on Desert Island Disc now, I'd go, there you go, there's your wand, you've got rid of it. But
if I was on a desert island, I wouldn't have it anyway.
Yeah. Right. Thank you very much for giving up your time, Cliff, to talk to me. It's been really, really interesting.
No problem. Thank you very much. It's been very nice to chat. I hope Cheers. Some of that made sense.
Definitely. Thank you.
You've been listening to Green Health.